I think that one of the most lovely features of the notions about God that I grew up with, the particular Christian notions about God, was this idea that God is near. And, you know, when I continued with my theological education, of course, I learned, you know, 12-cylinder words for that, but that's sort of the short version, is that I grew up with ideas about God that made it easier to imagine God being close, like someone that we love is close. Sort of a super friend, you know, like always proximate and in a lovely way. And that is really one of my favorite sort of features of when I think back on the notions of God that I learned as a young person. Malcolm Guite, who's a British poet that I've mentioned here before, has this poem that's called Descent that touches on this. And I don't share all of Malcolm's theological perspectives, even as they show up in the poem. Having said that, and having just spent a month wandering around in the remains of the very antiquity that Malcolm refers to in this poem, the Greco-Roman heritage, the poem feels especially poignant, and it really draws out a contrast between some of those Christian notions about God and the ones that preceded them as religious ideas. And I'll just read you the poem. It's not long, and I haven't subjected you to poetry for some time, so I'm feeling remiss. This is part of my gift to you that I do this. So, Descent. They, and the they in the, I'll let the poem speak. They sought to soar into the skies, those classic gods of high renown, for lofty pride aspires to rise, but you came down. You dropped down from the mountains sheer, forsook the eagle for the dove. The other gods demanded fear, but you gave love. Where chiseled marble seemed to freeze their abstract and perfected form, compassion brought you to your knees. Your blood was warm. They called for blood and sacrifice. Their victims on an altar bled. When no one else could pay the price, you died instead. They towered above our mortal plane, dismissed this restless flesh with scorn, aloof from birth and death and pain. But you were born. Born to these burdens. Born by all. Born with us all astride the grave, weak to be with us when we fall, and strong to save. That's a cherished perspective, that whole God came near idea. And in Christian theology, of course, we give it a word like incarnation, right? This idea that the divine could be enfleshed. And I just, there's so much that's beautiful about that. There's so much there that inspires and that motivates and moves me. And it's also, I recognize in it, a deeply comforting image. It shows up in some ways in almost every card that is taped on my dad's hospital wall right now. It's a very reassuring picture of the divine. And there's a pretty big problem with it as well. And before I go any further of this, just a couple of thoughts about what it's like to be part of the community at the table, both on a positive note, but also on a note of some critique. And it's not a critique of all of you, it's more of a critique of my perspective and role here. We exist to make room for the exploration of belief. That's our stated reason for being. And that kind of means that everything is up for grabs, right? Everything's open for being explored. And if you're in a space of wanting or needing to explore what you believe, I think that can feel pretty fantastic. Like that kind of freedom can just feel like, oh yeah, that's what I need right now. I had somebody recently email me to describe what we do here as, their words, wise and daring and special. And then they added that they felt like in their visits here, they had met God here. And that's lovely and affirming, and I feel so grateful that they took the time to communicate that. But that same space of exploration that struck them as wise and daring and special also didn't fit for them, and they came and they saw and they didn't stay. That space of exploring what you believe, at least as we tend to approach it here, is not necessarily what I would call comforting to people. It can be kind of heady sometimes. That's my fault in the main, philosophical, even theoretical. Sometimes it's not very reassuring. It can be pretty hard work. I had a conversation with someone in Saskatoon this past weekend who was quite aware of the characteristics of the table, who described it to me as, quote, pretty much the opposite of certain. I just burst out laughing. I'm like, wow, that is like the perfect summary of, you know, of the table in so many ways. And I expect that some of us, you know, we roll over on a Sunday morning and kind of look at the alarm clock or whatever and think, yeah, I'm not up for that this morning. And like, if it helps at all, I also have this experience. So far, I've managed to be here when I said I would. But it's hard work sometimes, right? Like, it's not necessarily an easy space. And as I was thinking about this, I was thinking, so what motivates me to keep on exploring? Like, why do I keep showing up for this? And the thing that keeps me showing up for spiritual exploration here and elsewhere is the thought that I might be blithely believing something that really is untenable. And I might be believing it just because it's what I'm familiar with or what I've been taught or what I find comfortable. Is untenable a word we all know? I don't want to be condescending in any way about this. I just want us to have some shared language. So let me just give us the formal understanding of that word. The word untenable, especially if we use it regarding a position or a view, which is how I'm using it this morning, for something to be untenable is for it to be not able to be maintained or defended against attack or objection. In other words, it just doesn't hold up when you really scrutinize it. What keeps me exploring is the thought that I might be, in an unconsidered way, believing something untenable. I feel like there might not be anything more important in this life than exploring what we believe. And I also think and have experienced that kind of honest delving into that realm of spiritual exploration is as good a way to meet the divine as any that I know of. And it's also a way, I think, to be positively formed as a person who has a spirituality that is honest and that is dynamic. Somebody that can look their beliefs in the eye basically on any given day and say, I am not through with you yet. I'm not done with forming this. I'm not done being formed by this. And I think that critique that the work of exploring can come up short on comfort and affirmation is also totally legit. One more thing, and then I'll get back to the problem that I mentioned. We live in a world that is changing at such a rapid rate that I believe that if we don't become adept at exploring what we believe, we are just going to find ourselves standing on the sidelines of the cultural conversation wondering where everybody went. If we do not learn to cultivate belief systems that can handle rapid cultural transit, we're hooped as far as our belief systems having anything to say to the prevailing culture or the prevailing culture being able to speak to us in a comprehensible, informative way. Having said that, I think we also need to learn how to calm our minds in the midst of a world like that, and more on that another day. But for now, the problem, okay? So there are a few different ways we could come at this, and today I'm going to come at it through some thoughts about thoughts and prayers. And I've already sort of touched on, Mike, what you said, which got me really kind of churning on that, and as I was already working on this other set of ideas, all of a sudden as I was working on them, and this happens once in a while, I went, oh, there's this intersection here, and I'm going to try to see if these things can speak to one another. So that's where I'm coming from. It's going to take more than one week of talky bits to do that, because there's big ideas, you know, aren't there always. But let's start with a question. Why do we pray in the first place? That does not have a uniform answer, but I'm going to take a particular perspective on it for the purposes of kind of opening this, all right? We've talked about this one before, and in some ways I feel like those conversations were headed for this one, but I'm going to back up my own memory truck a ways and think about why what I learned about the answer to that question when these ideas were being formed in me. One of the first things I remember kind of being taught in answer to a question like, why would I pray, is that prayer was conversation with God. Prayer was talking to God in particular. That when we pray, that's what we're doing. We're talking to God. And in my kid imagination, that worked pretty good. I liked the idea that when I said, Dear God, someone was right there listening to me. That's that cherished, comforting idea that I was talking about a few moments ago. What is not to like about that? Right? Like, the idea that God, the ultimate bar none being in the universe, is listening to me. How lovely. How awesome. But what does that mean? Not a question for a four-year-old, maybe, although there are probably four-year-olds in this room. I have that kind of capacity. When I think about that, I think, well, that sort of depends on my notion of how God operates in the world, doesn't it? If God is right there listening to me when I pray, and God is all-powerful, which is classic Christian theology about the nature of the divine, right? Even though philosophers through the ages are fond of pointing out that the idea that God is all-powerful just simply doesn't work, along the lines of, can God make a rock too big for God to lift, and so on. But classic Christian theology has this idea that God is all-powerful, and so then if I can get God to sort of see something my way, I've kind of got the ultimate ally, right? Like, it doesn't matter what I'm on about, if I have this all-powerful being on my side, I'm going to be crushing it, right? Like, how do you rise above that ally? That wasn't in my notes. That just happened. God have mercy. Okay. So if I can get an unstoppable force on my side, whoop, right? Now, of course, that same classic Christian theology that affirms this idea that God is all-powerful also says that God is all-good. And so the qualifier is that whatever I'm enlisting God as an ally in, it needs to be good. Now we're into murky terrain. Anyway, we're going to leave that. Then as I got older, and I started to think about this a little bit more on my own, and I started to have some further questions, I was introduced to the idea that this isn't a monologue, that prayer isn't just me talking to God. It's a conversation. It's a dialogue. Prayer is also listening to God. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a conversation, right? Just be me talking at God. So now, prayer became, in my imagination, both talking to and listening to God. Now, all of this presupposes that God is both a being and a personal being, neither of which are a given. Even if we grew up soaking in those ideas, they're not a given. In any case, I think that fills out the picture a little bit. Obvious problem. In these prayer conversations, how does God speak, and how will I know that it's God that I'm hearing, not some clever, devious counterfeit that wants to deceive or confuse me? Because that whole system of belief that presupposes that God is both a being and a personal being most often also presupposes that I, the human doing the praying, am deeply flawed and limited, broken is the word I remember best, so I'm vulnerable to that sort of deception, right? In a system of belief that is framed like that, it sure would help to have some kind of objective reference point to check things against, right? Bunch of you already know where this is headed. If you're wondering if the voice you're hearing is God's voice, that's where the Bible comes in. The Bible is that reference manual in that system of belief. It's the objective document against which you check the things you are uncertain about. I'm going to stay out of the potentially very deep weeds regarding a question like what is the Bible at this point for the sake of time. I don't feel like I'm leery about the question. I'm just not going into it this morning. Except to point out that really doesn't work, using the Bible as a reference manual, not least of all because the Bible can't even agree with itself about all kinds of things. It was not written to be a coherent or comprehensive reference manual, and when we try to make it behave that way, it will misbehave. And I say that with deep confidence because even the most cursory glance at history reveals enormous shoving matches about whose perspective on what the reference manual means is right. And those shoving matches is way too benign because people have killed one another in droves historically from this perspective. And that just says to me there has got to be a better way to look at that whole question. But back to why we're praying in the first place. In this framework, and I know it's not the only one, we're talking to God largely because we want God to intervene. We want God to get involved in human affairs. And we're listening to God so that we know how to cooperate with that intervention, so that we know how to be on board with what God is doing. And that, I think, is actually a problem. Well, how so? Surely the problem isn't wanting to be in alignment with what God is doing. Like, really, Tim? You know, could that be the problem? And I would say no. I think it would be really hard to argue that being aligned with the divine is anything but good if any part of our notion of the divine is that the divine is good. I think the problem is actually on a layer that's a bit deeper in the framework than that. The problem is on the layer where we assume that God is interventionist at all. Little pause button. If you have a cherished belief in an interventionist God, I want you to know that from my perspective, this talky bit is not an attempt to dissuade or even undermine that belief. We have the freedom to believe whatever we want, and one of my cherished hopes is that this is a community where we can feel that that's true. I shouldn't even talk about sadness today, that's a little raw, but I would be very sad to learn that that was not the case. And I would be even more sad to learn that that was not the case because I had presented some perspective with a strength of opinion or some passion, that somehow positionally that said, in this community, you can't believe different than what that guy said. I think that's, personally, just so you're totally clear on it, I think that's nonsense. But it's also understandable given our own histories with religion and authority and position and all those things. I just don't operate in that space. If I'm bashing away at something with some passion, it usually means that I'm bashing away at it inside with some passion, not that I've got it sorted. And if you all don't come along, you should look for a different church. Just to be as clear as I can. So I'm not trying to talk anybody out of any of that. And for my part, I'm not aware of any answer to the problems raised by the idea that God is interventionist that don't in turn raise other problems. So I don't really think there's a perspective on this that just sews it up. But that said, I also can't find it in me personally to be uncritically affirming of systems of belief that go unexamined. I'm kind of a dog with a bone that way, and that's just my jam. But I think that if we believe something, the least that we can do is be honest in our examination of it, including the problems as well as the potentials. And we can own the problems as well as the potentials about the things that we say we believe. All that really does is say my beliefs are limited, and I'm not through with them yet. But at least then we're kind of honest explorers. And one of the things that, if we're honest explorers, I think one of the things that that does is it allows us to hold our beliefs both passionately and graciously. It allows us to hold our beliefs in a way that means that we don't have to encounter a different belief than we hold and feel immediately like we're in an adversarial framework. We can encounter a belief that is different than ours and go, that's interesting, that's intriguing, how does that work for you? If it raises this problem, how do you address that problem? When you think about the way my belief system raises this other problem, what does your belief system say to that? And then we're in this rich world of dialogue and exploration that's just like afloat with possibilities instead of immediately kind of going, oh yeah, I got to get you over here where right belief lives. If we're being honest about the problems with our own beliefs, it softens the edges of all of that. And I think that's a good thing. One of the reasons why I think it's good is because it helps us become people who learn to live out of love rather than out of fear. And in the belief system that I've been steeped in my entire life, that feels really consistent with the big ideas in that system. So if you want text, go read 1 John chapter 4. Listen to this. There is no fear where love exists. Rather, perfect love banishes fear. And then the rationale is really intriguing in this text. For fear involves punishment. And the person who lives in fear has not been perfected in love. So from the biblical writer of 1 John's perspective, the idea that if we're afraid that we'll be punished if we go exploring and get lost, if we're having that sensory experience with our spiritual exploration, the writer of 1 John would say, love's not perfect in us yet. Because if love was perfect in us, we wouldn't be afraid of that. Right? So it seems to me that a community that takes seriously spiritual exploration is also a community that's trying to learn how to live in love and not fear. And the deeper we get into that terrain, the more the love starts to suffuse the exploration, the less we need to feel afraid when we encounter something we don't know or that we thought we knew but realize, oh, that's a different perspective. We don't need to have the experience of fear. That's grounded in an idea of the divine that the biblical writer of 1 John says is not a good idea. Those things cannot live together. If we think that God is just waiting for us to get it wrong so we can be punished, our own sacred text, if Christendom's sacred text is one we consider ours, says, bad idea. Bad idea about the divine. Not helpful. Interesting, right? I think that good beliefs, like any good method for learning and growing, need to assume that there is something more to be learned than what we know now, and that some of what we learn when we press into that unknown terrain is going to overturn things that we thought we knew. And it's going to overturn some of them in ways that are really radical. It's not just going to kind of tune them up a little bit. Some of them are going to get upended entirely. I think that's the assumption. And if I think about that 1 John text, that is not something we need to fear. We do not need to be afraid of that. It doesn't mean it won't be hard. It just means we don't need to be afraid. So, about the interventionist problem. Here's the short version of the interventionist problem. In order to believe that God intervenes in human affairs, we have to accept the notion that God is not only capable of controlling or altering human affairs, but is also inclined to do so. In other words, given all the horrible things that happen, God not only chooses to intervene, but to not intervene, sometimes on a rather grand scale. That's the short version of the problem of an interventionist God. So, in the same news cycle, we've got a rescued soccer team brought out just ahead of monsoon rains, and that story made my heart sing, just on so many levels, and not because it was without cost. An experienced diver died as part of that story, but that's a lovely story. And in the same news cycle, as of this writing, a current death toll of 155 after historic rains in Japan caused epic mudslides. So, do we really find it tenable to believe that in the one instance, people called out to God and God said yes, and in the other, people called out to God and God said no? Seriously? Or that somehow, in one instance, somehow those cries to the divine appeased the divine, and so the rescue was successfully convened, and in the other, well, we're not sure, but probably, like, what? A lot of people got the formula wrong. Or as the Old Testament Elijah suggested to all those prophets of Baal, maybe God was just in the bathroom and didn't hear them. That's actually not a reach as a translation, by the way. Like, do we really want to make these sorts of stories, whether they're distant as in a news cycle or personal as in the room next to ours or our family, do we really want to make these stories part of a binary universe where, as the Gospel of Matthew says, it rains on the just and on the unjust? Like, do we really want to operate our spirituality in that space? We'll come back to that rains on the just and the unjust idea next week. On the plus side of believing in an interventionist God, and there's lots of plus sides, but one of the really substantial ones, I think, is that belief in an interventionist God allows us to have a handy target when things go sideways. And this is not a small matter, and I am not poking fun or being facetious here. Having someone to blame when we are suffering, or having someone to rail at, has enormous therapeutic value. I am not going to raise, at least if I'm having a good Tim day, I am not going to raise the dilemma of an interventionist God with somebody who comes to tell me about a shattering experience in their life. That is not the time and place for that conversation. There's enough suffering in this room that I was reluctant about opening my notes this morning, but at some point in this structure, you make a commitment a week before and you grit your teeth and go, well, let's talk about it. Hopefully we can talk about it. These are hard things to wrestle with, and they're never harder than when we're shattered, and so maybe that's not the time. If we believe that God intervenes in human affairs and things go sideways, we have a target for the question, why did that happen? Why did that happen is actually not an answerable question. But, oh my God, do we ever need somewhere to ask it? We need somewhere to ask it. Why? Like, why is that? Horrible events that don't have any rhyme or reason to them happen everywhere in our world all the time. Sometimes they happen to us. They have no satisfactory explanation, but we still try very, very hard to find one. Why do we do that? I touched on this last week, but I want to take a little closer look at it this morning. A question like, why do we do that? Of course, that's irresistible to social researchers, right? To the psychologists, psychiatrists, sociologists gang. And so a bunch of folks at the University of Tennessee, they came up with this study that in which they gave students computer-generated analogies and then told them to come up with the logic behind them. The analogies were just generated by an algorithm. Like, they weren't logical. Some of them were not logical along the lines of, this is an actual example. So here's one of the analogies they were supposed to provide the logic for. Quote, horse is to time as stone is to brook. Don't try. Like, okay, horse is to time as stone is to brook. And these poor unsuspecting undergrads, like, they just waded right in there and they came up with logic for horse is to time as stone is to brook, and a whole bunch of others as well. They just solved them. Like, they did it. Oh, anyway, the lead reporting scientist on the study, a guy named Dr. Michael Johnson, would just basically sum up by saying that the search for meaning is fundamental to the human psyche. If we can't readily settle for the inexplicable, so we will use whatever means are at our disposal to explain randomly occurring events. We just will. And if we're religious, we might see the randomness as signs from God. Right? It kind of makes sense, doesn't it? Like, if we have this drive and we have this available system to work with, we're going to work with it. And so we do. We might imagine those events to be part of a larger plan. Zeke, you touched on this morning a little bit, right? We do this. I don't say this as a critique. It's just a fact. We just go there. We might see those events as part of some grand master plan. We might use language like, we might say this is the will of God. We might say this is what God is up to. This is a God thing. Like, we have all these religious phrases that we use that basically assign something random to the intentionality or intervention of the divine. Because we have this enormous drive to explain horses to time as stone is to brook. Now, if we're just plain old superstitious, not religious, we might think that, you know, not shaving is going to help our team win the playoffs. That's got nothing to do with this, by the way. That's another story I'll tell another day, but there is a story. I'm cheering for Croatia, for what it's worth, just because they're the underdogs. Or we might think that, you know, wearing our lucky socks is going to help our team win the playoffs or whatever. Sometimes it's really hard to tell superstition and faith apart, right? Superstition actually can really easily be mistaken for faith, and historically often has been. And in fact, it's not very hard to make the argument that superstition is a kind of faith. It's not one I personally encourage or endorse, but it is a belief system. But there it is. To put it into the vernacular, shit happens. And to quote a literary mentor of mine, shit is senselessly democratic in its shittiness. He's a man of letters, this particular mentor. In other words, there is no discrimination about who deserves it and who doesn't. It is, to use that writer's words again, mercilessly random. There is something inside of us that just hates that idea and demands an explanation. And if we have to make horses to time as stone is to brook work to get it, then we will. There's going to be a part two, which we'll wait into next week, in which I hope to propose what I find to be a quite hopeful, faithful way forward in this dilemma. I think there is one. But I'm going to leave that for next week. But what I'm going to leave us with going into that is what I think is a really interesting story from Luke's gospel in which Jesus offers his take on this, which I don't think a lot of people read this story this way, but I think this is a very legitimate reading of the story. As Luke tells the tale, what happens is that some people come to Jesus and they tell him a story, and the story is about how Pilate, a familiar name to any of us who grew up with the Christian narrative, and Pilate's like the top Roman representative in the region where these stories happen that Luke is telling. And a bunch of people come to Jesus to tell him a story about how Pilate has slaughtered a group of Galilean pilgrims who are in Jerusalem to make their customary sacrifices to the Hebrew God, to Yahweh. The Romans liked to give the people they took over room to practice their own religion, but only if it didn't get out of hand. They gave them that room to keep them in hand, in fact. It was quite the deliberate strategy. So this one got sideways, and Pilate had slaughtered a group of these Galilean pilgrims. Jesus responds, and I'm just going to paraphrase the actual Luke text. You can look it up for yourself if you want. It's in Luke 13. Jesus' response to that was basically this: look, I know what you're thinking, but you're wrong. This isn't the Galileans being slaughtered by Pilate. This is not God's way of punishing those Galileans for something awful that they've done or for some sin that they've committed, which would have been the prevailing paradigm for how God operates in the world. They're just regular folks like the rest of us. They're no better and no worse. And then you get the sense when you're reading Luke within the imagination that he kind of looks around at the crowd and they're not looking very convinced. Either are you. And so he keeps going, and he says, while we're on the subject, those 18 people that were crushed that other week when the Tower of Siloam fell on them, they're no different than you or me or anybody else that's living in Jerusalem. Shit happens. I told you this was a paraphrase. But unless you learn to see things different, to find a new mindset, you're walking on the road of death already. You're perishing on the inside just like the Galileans perished on the outside. Huh. That's an interesting story about how God operates in the world as relayed to the people by Jesus. It sounds to me as if Jesus isn't all that fond of the prevailing religious explanation of his time, which is that if something bad happens, someone had to be blamed. Which is, by the way, the entire framework for substitutionary atonement. Again, another day. Maybe this is as good a place as any to leave off today with a personal question along the lines of something like this. How do I explain it to myself and to others when really awful things happen? What's my internal explanation for it? What's my external explanation for it? And are those the same? When I respond to that fundamental existential human question, why is this bad thing happening? Why is it happening to me? Why is it happening to someone I love? Am I answering the question outside the same way I'm answering it inside? And what's the relationship between how I answer that question when awful things happen and the way that I explain the world in which random good things also happen? Or maybe not random. How do I answer that question? Why am I experiencing something good when somebody else isn't? All right, more on that next week. And in the meantime, I would just offer us the reminder that from at least where I sit, we don't need to be afraid to explore what we believe. Peace.